Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on April 7th, 2026, and time to convene the regular meeting of the Snohomish County PD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioner Julie Altamirano Crosby, our Vice President. Joining soon will be Commissioner Tony Olson, our Secretary. And with us today, John Hoffman, our Chief Customer Officer, Colin Willenbrock, our Chief Operating and Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, and Maureen Stoltzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices at this time. I forgot to do. This time, I'm going to say the flag salute, and you're welcome.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
And to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Copies of the agenda are located on the table near the entrance. Are there any items to be added or changes to be made to the published agenda, Commissioner?
I have none.
Comments from the public is item two on the agenda, and that's when the board will hear comments that will be limited to 3 minutes. The person shall be recognized to speak from the sign-up cards located in the deputy clerk's table near the entrance. If you're joining by Zoom, click raise hand or dial star 9 if by phone. I will call on you to speak at the appropriate time. When you're called upon and on a phone, you'll need to dial star 6 to unmute. This meeting is being recorded. When addressing the board during the meeting, please step up to the podium, use the microphone, state your name, and indicate where you are from. Please remain at the podium while you speak and address the commissioners, not the audience. If you have documents or the materials to enter into the record, please hand them to a deputy clerk who will distribute them to the board. We appreciate your cooperation with our procedures. Please note that all motions receive an automatic silent second from the board. This ensures that all issues can be brought to the floor for discussion. So first off, item 1A, Employee of the Month for April, Jessica Bellaney. Colin Murphy here to introduce Jessie. I bet I mispronounced her last name.
I think she'll forgive us for that. So. Good morning, commissioners. My name is Colleen Murphy. I'm the Manager of Environmental Affairs, and it is my honor to introduce Jessie Balbiani as our April Employee of the Month. Jessie's been with Environmental Affairs for almost 4 years, and in that short time, she's made an outsized impact on our programs, on Team PD, on the internal and external customers we serve, and on environmental protection in our community. When I heard that Jessie had been selected, I was not surprised. She's exactly the kind of employee this program was designed. I want to share a little perspective on the work that our environmental affairs team does, and then I'll share a few concrete reasons why Jessie stands out. Environmental affairs is a small team with a wide range of responsibilities. There isn't really a typical day. One day we might be advancing our sustainability plan, and then the next day we're out in the field getting dirty, working with teams throughout PUD on chemical use or waste management, critical areas protection, and yes, even spills. Much of our work happens behind the scenes. If things go well, you may never hear about us. But when something goes sideways, especially with a spill, the situation can be high stakes for the environment, for safety, and for customer trust. That's when we're called in to help teams respond quickly and do the right thing. And in those moments, when the work is complex and time-sensitive, Jessie shines. First, Jessie is deeply committed to environmental protection. She brings a high standard to her work, and just as importantly, she brings people along with her. She doesn't just hand teams a list of requirements, she explains the why. Helps find practical ways to meet expectation and stays engaged until the solution is working in the field. Because she sees the big picture and makes sound decisions, projects move forward with fewer surprises, less rework, and stronger relationships across departments. Second, Jessie makes the work better for the people around her. She's approachable, positive, and has a real talent for turning a complicated environmental topic into something clear and doable. Some of her proudest moments are when she helps someone else see environmental protection differently because she took the time to listen, explain, and make the right path feel achievable. Jessie's commitment to Team PD goes beyond environmental compliance. She consistently lives our values. The employee who nominated her wrote that her positive attitude and safety-first mindset are relentless, making the process clear and simple. They also highlighted her customer service, communication, adaptability, respect, and courage before closing with, "Our department cannot express enough that we will be forever grateful for her service." A few other Team PUD members shared what it's like working with Jessie. One said, "One of the highlights of my Fridays is getting to work alongside Jessie. She brings kindness and warmth to every interaction. And whenever I have an environmental question, she either has the answer or goes out of her way to help me find it." Another said, "Jessie's really sharp and dependable. I was impressed that when she started, she wanted to learn our processes and even SAP rather than just handing it off. Working with her is always an effort because of her upbeat attitude and sense of humor." The third said, "Jessie's been a pleasure to work with on spills and disposal. She's always willing to meet, talk through options, and improve efficiency and safety. We're lucky to collaborate." Finally, I've asked Jessie to jump into all kinds of tasks, from meeting with students to serving on communities. She always brings perseverance when things don't go according to plan, and she has wicked smarts. One of the best ways to describe Jessie, though, is through our job shadow program. So last year, the environmental affairs team did this internal customer outreach for other departments to help them get to see who we are as a team, how we can help them in their jobs. Jessie's played a really big role in putting this program together, and it's really helped us get our voice out there, get our message out there so people know more about us. So when Jessie gets up to do her part of the program, she walks people through a virtual spill response where she's explaining the whole process from spills. So she'll start out with, we get the call, we get the notification, here's the research that we do in the office before we even go out into the field. And then here's the work that we do in the field and the cleanup and all the documentation. She explains it very clearly and she makes it meaningful. And then she goes in with some details. So she'll bring up the first slide picture of a spill that she's responded to, and she'll go, "Oh, this was my favorite spill." She's like, "We have this challenge, we have this challenge, we had traffic, we had equipment, we had streams here." And she talks about each of the challenges that we encountered and how she addressed them. And she goes to the next slide and she says, "Actually, this is my favorite spill." And then she repeats the process about all the challenges that she's encountered. By the time she's done with her presentation, she's had 5 or 6 favorite spills. And the people think, "Wow, spill response must be really fun." So if anybody can make spill response that fun, it's definitely Jessie. That is just Jessie. She brings the ownership, expertise, and care. And she brings people along with her. Other departments know she's partnering with them to solve real problems the right way. She sets a high bar for environmental affairs and for Team PUD and makes the people around her better. Commissioners, please join me in congratulating our April Employee of the Month, Jessie Galmiani.
To meet you, sorry to butcher your name.
No,
please come up.
Galmiani?
Galmiani.
Jessie, thank you for what you do. It sounds like an amazing teammate. And although I can't imagine spills being favorite, I can imagine the unique challenges of each one and trying to figure out how to best to remediate to solve all the various problems. But I would just be worried as I see oil going down a stream.
It's
unfixable. So I'm glad you're there and I'm glad that you were involved in the Jackson project.
Thank you. Yes, it's certainly exciting. So yeah. You're addicting. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for all that you do. I cannot even imagine cleaning the spill, so jumping when it's the spill, it's like, this is my favorite one. No. But I heard that you like kayak.
I do, yes.
Okay. Never imagine, never done that. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah,
and you sound like an incredible teammate. So. Thank you. Comments. I wonder if you have a video of the 1,000 ping pong balls.
I wish. I wish I.
That would really be
punished. Yeah. Well, the rumor was that right when I did that prank, he went on vacation. And so there was a week that the ping pong balls just sat in his cupboard.
Waiting.
But I didn't know that the cupboard was the communal coffee spot.
Oh.
So his coworkers went to lift the cupboard and saw ping pongs fall and then immediately closed it and saved it for when he came back to the office. So it was a prank across multiple people.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very effective. Very effective. It was retaliation, though. I did not start this prank war. I just, you know,
yeah.
reciprocated.
I got
so,
you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, and thank you to Generation. There's a couple Generation people here today, and they, in terms of the Jackson spill, did all of the heavy lifting and couldn't have done it without them, so thank you.
Well, we have a few things for you here.
Okay.
Well, I miss Tony. I don't know what Tony can say. Well, beautiful picture.
Thank you.
And we have a award certificate.
Very nice.
Or swag, I think, or whatever.
Yeah, perfect.
Great. Yeah. And then we have a trophy for your trophy case. And we found out recently these are breakable.
Oh. I won't bring it on a spill with me. I'll keep it in my
face. Picture of it, put it on your phone.
Yes. Put it on my.
Yeah. Then show the person who pranked you.
Oh, yeah. Don't
oh.
tell
yeah.
people.
You have
to, seeing the
yeah.
word. Yeah.
Well, can we get some pictures?
Sure.
Let's put here. Let me hold the trophy.
Thank you.
Send these ones to Allison.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And we congratulations. We always offer the recipients to say some words if they would like. The rest of the audience or
yeah, I just thank you so much. The praise is overwhelming. And again, I think just unlimited praise to the Generation team. And we love working with them so much and they're really good partners. So really appreciate that.
Glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome. This item two comes from the public. Are there any comments from the public for items not on the agenda? Please state your first and last name for the record. Seeing no hands up in the room, we've got no blue cards, and I'm seeing no hands up online. We'll move along. And the next item three, our consent agenda. 3A, approval of minutes for the regular meeting of March 17, 2026. 3B, bid awards, professional service contracts and amendments. 3C, consideration of certification / ratification and approval of district checks and vouchers. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Are there any questions or comments, Commissioner?
No, I have none.
I have none either. I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Next is item four, our CEO General Manager briefing and study session. This item is for the board and our general manager to discuss issues among ourselves and the PUD staff. Today, filling in for our GM is Chief Customer Officer John Hoffman, who will facilitate the discussion. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. And we have another action-packed morning for you this morning. So we'll start right off with the media report from Aaron Swaney.
Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Swaney, Manager of Communications and Marketing.
Good morning.
Action-packed.
Action-packed.
Yeah, that might be setting the bar a little too high. Jump right into it. So we had a really nice story run in the Latino Herald. It was kind of a story that run the gamut of energy efficiency, being prepared for outages, emergency kit preparation, you know, some of our assistants. It really was kind of a nice story that really told a lot about what we do for our customers. What it was a collaboration between us and customer service. So Erica Keene, our PR and media liaison, worked with customer service and our bilingual CSR, Naomi Pullen, to connect her with Jose Luis, who's the editor of Latino Herald. She sat down and interviewed with him, and it turned out really, really well. And that's a tough job. I mean, she's got to sit there and be in the hot seat and take a lot of the questions. And we prepared her, and Erica did a really good job with that. And it turned out to be a really nice story. They did a video as well, and I think down the road might do something with that. So just really, really happy with how it turned out, and proud of the teams working together. Next up, we had a press release go out on just all of the infrastructure improvements we've done up in North County. So you've got the North Camino sub, Twin City sub, and the new high voltage line that's been constructed up there. And obviously teasing Thursday's ribbon cutting. So that got picked up by a number of publications, including the San Juan Camino News. And then finally, you wouldn't tell by the weather we're having right now, but the weather has been a little wild lately. Spring in the Northwest can be a little unpredictable, and we had a windstorm a few weeks ago, and then we actually had our second spill of the season at Spada, which is very rare. So that was picked up by a number of publications, and just kind of working through some of that. And we're doing a lot of education with reporters right now. A lot of younger reporters are calling us, asking us questions that we haven't gotten for years. Some of us, you know, talking about what we do. A lot of us think we're the county. So it's a little bit of an interesting world. And like I said, a lot of education, and we're always up for it, especially around storms. Now onto publications. Current will be hitting mailboxes next week. A lot of it is on the Energy Block Party, getting prepared for our big party at the end of this month for Earth Day. But we also touch on a number of different things, including really stressing the value of public power, and just really what goes into that and why we're different than investor-owned utilities. So really trying to communicate a lot of that to our customers, and also a lot with water and celebrating Connect Up. So you'll see that mailbox is, like I said, April 15th.
You know, it's getting much easier to show the example of the benefit of public power to watch our neighboring utilities with really enormous rate increases and predictions for many more years of enormous rate increases.
I concur. And I think you could see why we're stressing it a lot. I think it was in the wire in March. I think that topic of conversation on affordability and the value of what we bring as a public power entity, it's something that we'll be continuing to lean into.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, I've shared this with some people that I know, is that, you know, this utility, all its assets originally came from the utility, right? So citizens of Snohomish County and Camino decided to go this option. Here's where they are today. Anyway,
enough said. I agree. And then again, Energy Block Party. So you're going to be hearing a ton about this month. We've got ads running in newspapers and print. We've got ads running on radio, on podcasts, on TV. We've also sent a postcard out to a lot of our customers right in this area. So we do that every year to the zip codes here in Everett. We've got social media. So Krista and her social media team is doing a bang up job of getting some fun stuff out there, working with line crews, working with, you know, you can see on here, we got some photos of some of our staff as younger individuals and kind of doing some fun things like that.
Is it possible to share who that beautiful child is?
Shauna,
is that an employee's job?
Shauna from customer services has been a ham since she was born.
That is Shauna Bozeman. Yeah.
There's a whole series out there on social media, Commissioner, of different employees.
Yeah.
And their pictures when they were a child.
Yeah.
In preparation, I think.
It's a social media trend, right?
Yeah. We
jumped on the bandwagon.
It's pretty fun to see people.
Yeah. So lots of fun.
We need to send pictures while we're in babies.
Oh, I don't think so.
I'm going to say no, but
we need questions now.
We would love that. All the best. That is it for me.
Thank you. Any questions for Erin?
Yes, I do. First of all, thank you for the presentation. I have a question. How often do you collaborate with the Latino Herald? Saying, like, if we want to build consistency with our community, they speak Spanish.
Yeah.
So it's not only, to me, it's not once every 2 months or something, doesn't build anything, and we have to create a foundation in order to develop that synergy with constituents.
I couldn't agree more. And I should have brought that up. That's something that Erica is going to definitely be kind of stressing more, is reaching out to Jose Luis when we send out press releases, just kind of nurturing that relationship. So Energy Block Party is a great example of that. We'll have a press release going on out on that in a few weeks. But following up with that, with more information or opportunities for interviews, things like that. So yes, definitely.
I recall there's like 80% of the Spanish speaking people, based on population, that are dealing with
Mohammed
economy. So,
is
that big?
Yeah, and that's no different than what we do for all the other, you know, like the Every Herald, things like that. So,
yes. And how many, you mentioned that we're going to send the publications, right? How many we're going to send that?
So, the current goes to every customer. So, it's about 365,000 copies go out to every customer.
Wow, that's so nice.
Straight to their mailbox.
And regarding the Energy Block Party, are we going to do this in social media with Latino Herald as well in Spanish to invite diversity? I have no idea.
That's a good question. That's what I'll follow up on.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Any other questions for Erin?
You know, Erin? Okay, go ahead.
Well, I'm kind of, maybe I should. Block party. I'm going to say anything. Block party.
Yeah.
Given the pretty prestigious award we received from the EDC, the utility received.
Oh, for the safety award?
No. For there were two categories. Wasn't. Okay, I didn't say anything.
Tony, yo creo que no debes decir nada ahorita.
I know what you're talking
about. Don't let it drop. Let's not fly and die.
Erin, I just had a comment, and maybe we've done this, and I don't really know. You know, when I started the PUD, I had no idea that the PUD was involved in the environment in any particular way. I didn't know we did work with birds and bird mitigation.
Yeah.
And so I know, just thinking about our Jesse, who is here today, I know we've done a lot about the salmon work and the work on the Salton. Are we in social media sort of getting out those various aspects of environmental work we do?
Yeah, I would say we're trying to, you know, especially following on like community engagement events where we're going out to the birding festivals, things like that, where we're talking about the mitigation efforts we do around that kind of stuff. We could always do more. You know, we can always do more kind of around our environmental affairs and just the work that we do for sustainability. But yeah, we do stuff, especially with, I said, birds and
yeah. And now that you said, I guess I do remember post where we had storms talking about spill.
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Erin. Next up, we have the Columbia River System Operation Verbal Update with Harrison Marr.
Good news, right?
It depends how you think about it. It's not great news,
you know.
But I appreciate the opportunity to give you an update, commissioners. My name is Garrison Marr. I'm the senior manager of power supply. We did provide an update right after the preliminary injunction was issued by the 9th District Court on Columbia River System Operations. And we wanted to provide another update now that BPA has initiated some processes to work through the financial impacts of that. So as a quick refresher, last time I spoke with you all, we talked about the potential impact of the injunction from a power side and a financial side, both in terms of BPA's finances and the PUD's finances. So as a quick refresher there, the power reduction is about 407 average megawatts is a reduction in output due to increased spill that results in more power purchases that Bonneville needs to make, as well as fewer sales that Bonneville can make into the wholesale market. At that time, we expected that the financial impact could be as much as $140 million per year. And at our scale, at the PD scale, you know, about $12 to $15 million per year. But what was not known was how Bonneville was going to work through those potential impacts and how that might show up for us. Staff discussed three potential things that Bonneville could do. One of those things was to use some part of the financial reserve surcharge framework, though that has a cap of $40 million that Bonneville could collect, and the expected impact is much larger than that. They could use the cost recovery adjustment clause, which does not have a cap, but does require Bonneville to spend down their reserves, their financial reserves, to 0 days cash on hand. So risky from a financial perspective for that organization, probably not their first choice. Or Bonneville could initiate a special rate case and adjust rates in light of, you know, the changing operating environment. We thought that was probably what they would do. And as of, you know, about last week, that is what they have done. So they have initiated the special rate case process and shared some initial staff leanings on what the refined scope of the cost recovery needs are and staff's leanings on the ways to do that. So today we'll talk through what those are and what that might look like at the PUD scale, as well as some of the timing implications for that. So this is where the good news comes in. You really have to find the rose-colored glasses to view this as good news. You know, I did mention a cost range before to the PUD and at the BPA scale, the refined cost range that Bonneville shared is within that cost range, but it's not the higher end of that cost range. So that is some positive pieces. Said up to $140 million a year. Bonneville thinks it'd be $125 million per year in fiscal year 27 and 28. At the PUD scale, we said the range could be between $12 and $15 million per year last time around. With the refined estimates, that looks like $13.75 million per year. That would be fiscal year 27 and 28. And just as a reminder, Bonneville's fiscal years are a little different than our fiscal years. Ours run January to December. Bonneville's runs September. So Bonneville's explanation for the rate case treatment, as opposed to those other tools, were really the same as I described earlier. Financial reserve surcharge, not enough. They felt like the cost recovery adjustment clause was too financially risky for the organization. So in order to keep financial reserves at a healthy spot, they're seeking to adjust rates through this rate process. They're also seeking to recover the cost of the impacts within this contract, the regional dialogue contract, which expires September 30th, 2028, because they don't want to have an equity issue of some costs incurred. This contract spilling over into the next contract where customers may have different products and there are likely to be some different BPA customers that weren't part of this preliminary injunction time period. So that's why we're in this special rate case. Staff leaning on the two different options. You know, I think there are some potential positives in these options as well. You know, Bonneville could just adjust rates to collect the additional $125 million per year from all customers. That is not exactly what staff is proposing to do. Staff's initial leaning are one of two options. One of those options would be that they would raise rates. And if not needed for the reserves, they would refund the additional amount back if hydro conditions allow for that. The other option is they could let conditions play out and collect through a surcharge, the additional amount needed. Both of those options are expected to collect $125 million, but the positive there is one has a potential to refund back some dollars if hydrology allows for it. The other one may not collect the full $125 million, front end, if hydrology allows for that as well. So both of those are better than just a, you know, straight rate increase. BPA staff leaning is towards solution A, is adjusting the rates but including a refund mechanism. That's also PUD staff's leaning. That will help us better plan in our budget cycle for what rates could be. We have a longer time cycle to plan for what we would do with any refunded amounts and make that, you know, a good outcome for customers. In terms of the timeline and next steps, we expect an initial proposal, which is Bonneville's kind of formal proposal for what to do next in May. Expect a record of decision from the administrator by the end of July, and we would expect the outcome of any rate adjustments to be effective October 1st of this year, which is the first day of their fiscal year 2027. So staff is monitoring this. We're showing up to the convenings. We will be active in the rate case to get the best possible outcome for our customers. And as we continue to move forward, we'll work internally with other PUD departments to make sure that we have a smooth process for our customers to process any changes that might come about. Any questions?
Questions, commissioners?
Okay. I have a lot, but I'm going to ask only this. For clarification, the $125 million per year, it's going to be only for 2 years. For how long? For clarification.
Yeah. In some respects, it's a function of how long the ongoing litigation takes. So, you know, this is an injunction that's being applied to the operation of the Columbia River system while that litigation goes on. So if it were to resolve earlier, you know, the injunction could be permanent or it could go away. If it goes longer, you know, this effect could extend as well. Current expectations are this will probably go fiscal year 27 and fiscal year 28, just the pace of the court system. Okay. I'd look to general counsel to see if there's anything that I've missed or misstated there on that expectation.
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic premise is the federal government is being enjoined or stopped from implementing current operations. And so that's why there's increased spill. The increased spill results in less generation. Less generation results in higher costs to customers. Until they resolve that, and the argument is that the operation should be permanently modified to allow for more spill, which the belief is will have a beneficial impact on fish, could result in costs being incurred by customers forever, potentially, if operations were permanently modified. In the meantime, as Garrison said, while the litigation is ongoing, those operations are permanently put in a status quo holding pattern that results in that higher spill. So until the litigation is resolved, or until the injunction is lifted, that's the current status that we'll be in for the foreseeable future. And like Garrison said, no one knows how long, I mean, between appeals and motions practice, likely will be at least a couple of years.
Jovina has his hand raised hands or something.
Okay. Joe?
Good morning, commissioners. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. This is Joe Fina, senior for counsel here at the district. I just wanted to clarify, you know, just a couple of things. So the scope of this particular, you know, rate case, you know, by Bonneville is to recover, you know, the costs, you know, up until when the new provider of choice contract were to begin. So because we're already a year, you know, behind, you know, the time period to collect the under recovery to meet what Bonneville expected its financial reserves, to be, will be calculated in the next 2 years. So the $125 million is for fiscal year 27 and also for fiscal year 28. At the end of each of those, fiscal years, depending on the option, either option A or option B, there will either be a refund at the end of each of those fiscal years. If the operational characteristics, turn out that it was, beneficial, for Bonneville, and they didn't need to collect all of that money, or Bonneville will institute a surcharge in order to recover, that money. But each of those decisions will come on a fiscal year basis, and this particular rate case is only focused on fiscal year 27 and fiscal year 28.
Thank you for the clarification. So my understanding is this is a continuation of a case that's been going on for many years, right? And it's suspended by an agreement from the previous administration. And when the current administration ended that agreement, the case against the record. So, I mean, potentially the impacts can go on. The case can go on for many, many more years, and the impacts go on for many. But of course, we don't know the outcome. It could be helpful economically to Bonneville, or it could be more damaging. So I've got a quick question. So if I understand right, a lot of this spill is going to happen in the summer months, which are sort of the critical, it seems like, challenge when we have summer loads and the rivers are lower, less anyway. I imagine that will, Bonneville may have to go out on the market, purchase power, which won't be clean. Is it going to end up meaning that we'll have to purchase more RECs, and will that, if so, will that be a substantial cost to us, or do they have to clean up this power, right?
Yeah. Until 2030, when the Clean Energy Transformation Act starts being a compliance obligation for Washington state utilities, the RECs that we're purchasing are for the Washington Energy Independence Act, which is the renewable portfolio standard for purchasing wind, solar, and other renewable types. So it shouldn't have an impact on our REC procurement strategy. If we get into 2030, it may have an impact on some of the RECs needed for CETA compliance.
Any questions?
Well, kind of related in terms of schedule. Is there any anticipation that that schedule will need to be modified based on the replacement of the administrator?
It's not what we've heard yet from BPA staff, which is great. That is going on in parallel. And, I should mention that BPA is introducing a no contest type of procedural element to this, which may help them expedite their process. But the first workshop, there was a lot of discussion. And so that may not be the track that winds up
taking
shape.
Thank you.
Next up, we have the Mount Lake Terrace Main Street Revitalization Project Phase 2 with Daniel Lin.
Good morning, commissioners.
Morning.
My name is Daniel Liu. I am one of the engineers in the Distribution Engineering Services team. I also serve as the lead engineer for distribution level relocation program projects. And today I have the privilege of sharing with you about one of the many projects that we're working on in distribution, that is phase two of the Mount Lake Terrace Main Street Revitalization Project. Before I begin, I'd like to briefly introduce a few individuals that are with me today. We have JC Dahlbeck, who is the project engineer, Aaron Burke, manager of distribution engineering services, as well as Andrew Flaherty, senior manager of transmission and distribution. And my hope is that between the four of us, we can answer any questions that you might have about this project. The purpose of this presentation ultimately is to establish an interlocal agreement between Snohomish County PUD and the City of Mount Lake Terrace for phase two of this revitalization project. The resolution for the interlocal agreement approval will be routed to the commission at a later date. I'd like to begin by sharing a few background pieces of information from the city's point of view. The Main Street Revitalization Project is a multi-year, multi-phase project that aims to spur economic development within the city of Mount Lake Terrace. Their hope is to transform about 82 acres of their town center area into a high density multi-use space that will ultimately be able to accommodate more than 6,500 new residents, businesses, and the jobs that would eventually follow. The first step in accomplishing that goal is to reconstruct a lot of key roadway and utility infrastructure that's within the town center. That began with phase one, which was completed in 2020 and delivered corridor improvements to 236th Street Southwest. You can see that on the figure within the right side of the slide. Phase two, which is where we're at now, will continue similar road improvements along 56th Avenue West. And if I recall correctly, there's a phase three that will soon be coming, delivering similar roadway improvements within the town center. We here in PUD Engineering began engagement for this phase of the project back in 2022. That's when JC started working with Mount Lake Terrace. And now, 4 years later, we're quickly approaching the start of the city's construction window. Our involvement with the project primarily centers around the relocation of existing PUD facilities located along the west side of 56th Avenue West. The picture that's shown in the slide is taken from the south end of the project looking north. And you can see here there's some underground, but the majority is overhead power lines that run along the west side of 56th. The city of Mount Lake Terrace has requested us to not only relocate these lines, but to actually underground all overhead lines along the corridor. So what that looks like for us is that we have a district relocation policy that states that if we have facilities that are located within the city right-of-way and they request us to move those, we will relocate those like for like at our own expense. But if the requester has a betterment or upgrade in mind, in this case, Mount Terrace wanting us to underground those overhead lines, they will be responsible for those additional costs associated with the undergrounding. One thing I will note is that we typically grant the city or requester a like-for-like credit in equal to the amount that it would have cost us to do a like-for-like relocation. But any costs that rise above that like-for-like amount is then the responsibility of the city to cover. Mount Lake Terrace can partially offset some of these undergrounding costs by preparing and installing the trench, vault, and conduit system for the PUD. This is something that we've commonly done for other municipalities, and we actually did something similar for phase one several years ago. And it ends up working out really well for all those involved because they're already doing a lot of the coordinating and installing of other services for utilities and communications out there for that project. So they have a more, I think you'd say, control over the coordination and costs of those utilities going in. We usually have engineers and inspectors on site to make sure that all things installed by the city meet our standards and specifications. The current estimated relocation and undergrounding cost for our portion of the work is $1.37 million. That like-for-like credit that I had mentioned earlier is currently at $417,000, leaving the city responsible for the remaining share of $953,000 on a time and materials basis. One thing to also note is that if we as the PUD decide to install any betterments that benefit us and are outside of this city's scope of work, we will be responsible for covering those additional betterments.
Does that then go on this particular area sorely in need of remodeling, I guess, but does then it go under back up to overhead?
Outside of the area of the
project? Yeah.
Yes.
Overhead going.
Yes. So if it does go back overhead outside, and We'll stay that way. Okay. We're only focused on the section that between, I think, 232nd and 236th. A couple additional project agreements, very similar to phase one. Town Center has a zero lot line rezoning requirement, meaning we'll be installing submersible switchgear units rather than our above ground pad mounted switchgear units. The picture shown on the slide here is actually one of those submersible switchgear units that we installed for Mount Lake Terrace on phase one. So they have familiarity with what it looks like, how much it costs, and it shouldn't come as a surprise to them on this phase of the project. Likewise, the city is also responsible for undergrounding existing customer services. As you recall, a couple slides ago in that picture looking north, most of the services to residents and businesses along 56th are currently overhead. So it'll be the city and city's contractors' responsibility to make sure that any service upgrades needed to keep those residents in power are taken care of. Mount Lake Terrace will be proceeding with advertising their project in June or July of 2026, with the intention of beginning construction soon after in August or September. They're anticipating a construction window of about 14 to 18 months, which ends up being a completion date of late 2027 or early 2028. All PUD labor will be performed by our in-house crews, but we can't begin our work until much of that underground infrastructure has been installed by the city of Mount Lake Terrace. At which point we'll be coordinating very closely with their contractor to make sure that our schedule aligns within their project window. The city will be acquiring easements on private property for PUD facilities. They'll be taking care of all negotiation compensation, but they will be sending us the easement documentation to be reviewed by our real estate group to make sure that it meets our standards. One final note is that if we have to place any of these switches within the city right-of-way, the city will be responsible for any future relocation costs if they request us to move those again in the future. In terms of next steps, we've been working closely with the city of Mount Lake Terrace to finalize the interlocal agreement language. Our PUD legal team has been preparing the cover sheet and resolution for approval of the ILA, and we'll be including that in a future commission agenda tentatively scheduled for the 21st of this month. That brings me to the end of my presentation. I'd like to ask if you have any questions for me and my team.
Any questions, Commissioner?
No, very good presentation. You mentioned easements. I'm glad they're doing it because I've been thinking.
I have none. As I do the presentation and all that ups and everything, questions there, that's really thank
you. I just have an observation and a question, which is probably for our general counsel. First, I noticed that looking at the map, it looks like it's phase one starts at their light rail station. So it's wonderful to see development and
as it goes.
Yeah, along light rail. I've been noting that as you ride the light rail, there's like no place to stop, get a coffee, then you like get to UW or something. So anyway, it's interesting. The second one is we do a lot of work with the city's other government agencies, but we don't do a lot of interlocal agreements. And I've never quite understood when we need to do them and when we don't need to do them. Is it because of the nature of the hybrid of this that they're doing some of the work or?
Yeah, so Interlocal Cooperation Act allows for the two governments to come together and form an agreement on a number of different topics and for a number of different purposes, but here, really important with a project of this scale to delineate, number one, who pays for what costs, number two, who will own what infrastructure at the end of the project and be responsible for maintaining it, and number three, liability, who's going to be responsible if there's mistakes or things that happen throughout the duration of the project. Outstanding collaborative effort here. We had an interlocal agreement with Mount Lake Terrace on phase one. This is now phase two of their project that they've morphed and adapted over time. Brenda White and the government affairs team have done a great job bridging those relationships. We've had several meetings here at the PUD to better understand the project. The whole project team's done just a great job. We've been working collaboratively trying to understand where the cost pressures are. My understanding of this is a federally funded project, so their budget is very tight, and so we want to make sure that we meet their expectations. They've asked us for some things that we don't normally do, but they want cost breakdowns of our costs to help them manage their budget. So really great collaborative project by everybody involved. That's typically why we do that, is to make sure there's clarity around those aspects of a project of this magnitude between two governments?
Well, if it's a simple project, like moving a couple of pools for a city, we just go on our cost sheet or whatever,
yep.
And we're not required by law to do an interlocal agreement with us.
And we have our customer service policies and
as
you've said.
Great presentation, Daniel. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Daniel. Next, we have the MRSC full roster with Clark Langstrand.
Good morning. Clark Langstrand, manager of contracts and purchasing. Here to just give you a heads up that on the 21st, we will be coming to you with a resolution. And this is an opportunity for us to increase the efficiency of our operation in contracts and purchasing. We currently maintain our own consultant roster for architects and engineers, which means that every couple of years we solicit A&E consultants to submit statements of qualifications, and then we store those for project leads to use throughout that 2 year period. And there's a selection process that is defined by statute, and we select those architects and engineers based on their qualifications and then negotiate price with the most qualified consultant. As you can imagine, that's quite a bit of staff time to maintain that. Throughout the 2 year period, we have some stats at the bottom, two bullet points. We get 142 submittals from various consultants across 14 categories that we use. We did 77 contracts in the 2 year period from 24 to 26. What we're looking to do is move the consultant roster to MRSC. They have a much wider scope than we do, so there's an advantage there. MRSC, if you're not familiar with them, is the Municipal Research and Services Center. It's a nonprofit that helps governments across Washington. It's legal and policy guidance. Some of you may be familiar with them. The advantage is that MRSC covers the entire state. They solicit SOQs, manage the consultant database. They make sure the advertisements are placed in all of the local papers for all of the agencies that they serve, things that we do now that we wouldn't have to do. We would still, district staff, project leads, and departments would still select the most qualified consultant from the list provided by MRSC. The resolution, of course, ensures that both organizations are acting according to the statute. We still have our requirements for that. What we'll see with MRSC is a lot more consultants across more categories. I took a couple of minutes to try and count, but the way that they have their website broken up, I would say that they probably have thousands of consultants and submittals, where we just have a much smaller number. It's used by agencies across Washington State. I think every city in Snohomish County, including Snohomish County, use the MRSC roster. So that provides efficiency for the consultants as well, because they just have one roster that they can join and make sure that all of the agencies, including PD, have access to their statements of qualification. The most we would pay, this is depending on our capital project budget, but it is capped at just under $4,000, which, if you think about the amount of staff work that we do, it's a small price to pay. It frees people on my team up to do things that are more important, have a higher impact than just maintaining SOQs. So that is the gist of what we're asking to do. As I said, I did say earlier that this resolution is a lot more prescriptive than some of the resolutions that we bring to you, but that's because MRSC wants to make sure that we understand that we have certain statutory obligations still, and all they do is provide those statements of qualifications. So as I mentioned at the beginning, on April 21st, we'll bring back a resolution for your review and full approval. Questions?
Questions, Commissioner?
So is this kind of like a headhunter for A&E work? My question is, we still are in the driving.
Correct.
Okay.
Absolutely.
They're not making They're a resource that we're using.
They're a resource. They're
basically, we issue RFQ or whatever you call it, and we manage the process. We do the selecting. Okay.
Thank you for that.
Just a comment, $4,000 is not a lot of money. This makes a lot of sense. And potentially we may save a lot more by connecting with some consultants who never would have been a part of our process.
Right. It does increase the competition. It also gives us the opportunity to reach out, like you say, to consultants that we haven't done business with before. It gives them an opportunity.
So you would selectively only issue the request for proposals? So or it wouldn't be a, you would let them know ahead of time, perhaps a certain ones that you're looking at, but you still would do an open process, which you need.
So we do it two different ways, depending on the size of the project and whether we have consultants on the roster currently. We might just go to the statements of qualification that we've already collected, and in a certain category, choose those consultants, and then review the statements of qualification, give them an opportunity to maybe do a presentation based on that project, and then we would select from them. We can also do a full-blown RFQ for a larger project. If it's you know, designing a building or something, some bigger project that has a higher dollar, and then we might do a standalone RFQ.
Yeah, it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in this era of work, architects, engineers, entities have a lot more flexibility in how they go about the process. It's not like necessarily just bidding a project, right? It's not as the qualifications aren't the lowest cost that meets the bid. We have some input into what we're looking for,
right?
For these kind of specials,
I have a question. How often do we have to update the resolution based on the price, the $3,950?
That's a really good question. When I put that amount in there, I didn't think about that. That amount doesn't rise to the level of coming to the board for approval. That would be just an administrative cost that we would maintain as the years go forward. I don't imagine that it will ever rise above the threshold for to commission for the dollar approval.
Thank you. Great presentation.
Thank you, Clark. Our last presentation in the morning, the strategic foresight and scenario planning work with Laura Lamb.
Shorter than Clark. Good morning, Commissioners. Laura Lemke, Program Director for District Strategy and Performance. I'm here this morning mostly as an... as an informational presentation to brief you on strategic foresight and scenario planning and how we use that in developing our strategic plan. And this conversation is in preparation for the workshop that we'll be doing together on April 16th, just to make sure that we all have a chance to put our heads in that space and be prepared to think about the future. This is what I jokingly refer to as my mall map. You'll see it as we go throughout this process over the next 18 months. Right now we are here. We are at the very beginning of our 2026 work on developing our 2028 to 2032 strategic plan. And as you can see, the next engagement with the commission will be on April 16th, where we'll be back in this room to do a hands-on workshop. And what will we be doing? So what is strategic foresight? I'm not going to read you the slide. I'm going to talk a little bit more about why it's important. Basically, foresight becomes the foundation of the way that we will develop our strategic plan, similar to what we did in 2021 and 2022. Using strategic foresight and this deliberate way of thinking about the future allows us to kind of take a pause and a step back and lift our eyes from the things that we have to do right now to the horizon to think about what could be important long term. It also helps us challenge our assumptions about what the future will bring so that we are not working from a place of just believing that we know everything that might come over the next 20 years. So that leads into why is it important? As you're aware, the world is kind of in an accelerating cycle of change. There's a famous strategic, what does she call herself? What does Amy Webb call herself? She's a futurist. Amy Webb is a futurist, and for 20 years she's done this like future of technology forecast report where she does scenarios about all of these things. It's 100 and some pages. It's a fascinating deep dive. And this year she came out and announced that she's no longer doing it. This isn't what they're the way they're thinking about the future anymore. They're thinking about it from a standpoint of convergence, because she used to believe that you could sort of take what was happening now and imagine the ways it would interact into the future and come up with different versions of it. And the point that she's making in her recent announcement about not doing it anymore is that change is happening sideways, forwards, in all directions at the same time. And it requires us to think about the future differently than we have before. The past is no longer predictive of what will happen tomorrow, next week, 10 years from now. And so the reason that we used strategic foresight, used it 5 years ago, was because we were in a pandemic that no one had predicted. And we thought it was important to take that step back. This time around, it feels even more important. It helps us improve the quality of our decisions and avoid overconfidence in any single view of the future. And ultimately, it helps us ensure that the strategic plan that we put into action for the next coming five-year period is responsive to today's issues, but also positions us for flexibility and effectiveness as real-world conditions change. It takes long-term responsibility and connects it with near-term action. So the way that shows up here in the organization is that we do scenario planning. Scenario planning is different than forecast planning, two graphics on the right-hand side. You'll often see, like, for financial work and other forecasts, you sort of take what we know today, you do a plus or minus 10%, you run a regression analysis, you say this is what I think is going to happen in the future. With scenario planning, instead, say, what do we know today? What do we think are all the important external driving forces out there? And how could they combine in interesting and unexpected ways to create versions of the future that are different than what we assume it will look like? We also do scenario planning as part of our integrated resource planning. What's different about scenario planning in this instance than in that instance is that when they do the integrated resource plan, I don't know why I like feel like I need a breath. Hold on. Take a breath, lift your eyes to the horizon. So when you do it for the integrated resource plan, basically we imagine these bunch of scenarios and the ways that it could be different in the future. And then we pick one and we plan for it. In this version of scenario planning, we don't do that. We're going to have four different versions of the future. We're going to go live in them. We're going to think about what it takes to be successful. And we're going to make choices about what we prioritize based on what helps us in multiples of those futures, including the future we assume will happen. So that's just a nuanced difference, but it's important to know that internally we were joking about Foresight Club and that there's 8 rules of Foresight Club. And the first 2 rules are both, we're not trying to predict the future. And the second rule is we're really not trying to predict the future. Like, that's not our goal here. Our goal is simply to challenge our assumptions so that we can make better decisions. I think it's important to note that if you are familiar with scenario planning in other organizations, sometimes the scenarios that they write are about how their organization could look different in the future, or it's very specific to their industry. Where is the utility industry going? Where is energy going? Our scenarios are taking the more traditional approach that was put in place through the Shell Corporation work in the 70s and Rand Corporation, a bunch of others, which is we're writing scenarios about how the external forces that we have no influence over could converge to create an operating environment that's different than we expect. So our stories are about our communities and our operating environment, not specifically about the utility industry or the way our operations look. That's the part that we do when we go live in the futures in the fall. So how do we use them? I've talked a little bit about this. But functionally, living in the futures helps us identify the capabilities we need to succeed across those multiple scenarios. And as we then arrive at the part where we define what our strategic plan is for the next 5 years, we'll use this work in the fall to identify the capabilities we must maintain. We're good at it now, and we need to be good at it no matter what the future brings. The capabilities we need to strengthen, those are the things where maybe we do it reasonably well now, but in multiple versions of the future, we need to be better at something than we are at the moment. And the last are the capabilities that we may need to develop. And those are things that aren't important right now, but will be 10, 15, 20 years from now. And we need to start the work today so that we're ready to do that in the future. What's a capability? It's a good question. if you're thinking it. What capabilities are things like technical expertise, processes and procedures, partnerships with regional partners or community partners and other organizations, our ability to do data and analytics, workforce skills, customer engagement strategies and approaches, and all of the other things that are basically like, how do we do our work? So when once we've done the Live in the Futures workshops in the fall, we've identified what these capabilities are that we need to focus, we'll use that to reaffirm our strategic priorities that we have now, make sure they're still the right priorities, and that are then set our five-year objectives for that strategic plan period to make sure that the things we're focused on in that 5 years are setting us up for success in the next 10, 15, 20 years. Take a breath. I don't know why I can't breathe this morning.
I need a glass of water, but I don't have any.
It's more than I'm just not breathing. It's not about needing a drink. Questions?
You should sit down, honey.
No, I don't. Questions at this point?
So if I wanted to paraphrase,
yes.
Say there's six potential futures we're looking at.
Yeah.
Five of them might have a commonality.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do something. We need to build this or...
Yep, we need to have this
that
thing.
That might become a high priority because
yep.
of five of the six possible futures, we see that thing common.
Exactly.
It doesn't go away, it keeps popping up.
It doesn't go away, it keeps popping up. We do that for both opportunities and challenges. And so we're looking to see, okay, there's an opportunity for us to do this thing in these multiple, in four of the futures that we're looking at or three of the futures. Or our ability to do this is really important. And sometimes we also see that our ability to do something becomes less important, and that's something that we should acknowledge as well, that maybe we're really good at something right now that we won't need to be good at in the future.
So do we look at just potential disruptive technologies?
Mm-hmm.
When we were talking this year, Governor Affairs team talking about plug-in solar,
yeah,
I wondered, you know, is there a possibility that that'll be our future and that that'll be so inexpensive that in the middle of the day when the sun is shining, we won't be selling any power to our residential customers because they'll effectively be making their own. And what would that do for our business model?
It is part of what we consider. There's sort of a nuanced fine line between the scenario work that we're doing here and the way we do it for the integrated resource plan. And I would say that I try to make sure that we stay in our lane here, which is sort of bigger picture.
Right.
And so we think about the fact that there might be disruptive technologies that would reduce our need to buy power from Bonneville or that type of thing. And it's maybe less important in this process than it is in the IRP to know exactly what they are, how they would show up, how we would use them. We mostly need to be able to acknowledge that in this version of the future, we have a lot of disruption. And in that version of the future, we don't for those pieces. You'll hear me say it in the workshop as well, which is one of the other rules of Foresight Club is the future is about technology, but not only about technology. And so we have to think about the way technology will change the world we operate in, but we also have to consider the way values might change and the way we interact with each other and what community looks like and that type of thing, because that can have just as big of an impact on the way we need to operate as technology does. So.
I don't have a question or comment, but I would like to add also, I mean, in those scenarios, do we include also the data centers and all that kind of stuff?
Data centers? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we would consider whether or not we think that, and I don't want to steal Angela Johnson's thunder. She will be here talking about large load, and I think next week, maybe the week after, next week or next meeting. But we would consider, you know, we understand right now what the environment looks like for those types of new loads. What do we imagine that might look like 5, 10, 15 years from now? Could something radically change that would be different than our assumptions about that? How that will unfold?
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that's a good example because unlike forecasting, which would predict loads go like this,
yeah,
something like that could make load like this.
It could.
Yeah.
Or there are other forecasts happening out there right now that say that that load is just going to be on an exponential growth curve for the next 20 years. But other disruptive technologies might come into play and that might not be true.
Yeah.
And so that's part of what we do when we think about scenarios.
It's also a good scenario because that was actually one of the scenarios that was predicted, the rise of the machines. I am very excited to participate in this because the scenarios were ended up being remarkably close to today. So
yeah,
good work.
It's been interesting. So I'll talk about this a bit in a moment, but last time around we did 5 scenarios, and as part of getting ready to do this again, I've been rereading them. We were shockingly prescient in a lot of ways. None of them is like the future as it's currently unfolding, but elements of the future are in all of them. And so it feels like we did pretty good work 5 years ago. So how do we do this? Basically, we develop our focal question, which is the same this time as it was last time, but we're looking 5 years further on into the future. And so the question we're asking our scenarios to answer is, what might the communities we serve look like in 2045? And how might our region and operating environment change? To answer that question, we have sort of a 4-step process to get us to the part where we have scenarios, and then we go live in them. So the first step is that we identify all of the relevant external forces in play. That's population change, technology, migration, climate change, all of those types of things. And that's the very first step, is we brainstorm all of the external forces. The second step is that we identify which ones we think are the critical uncertainties. And those are the ones that could most affect our communities and their needs. And they are also the most uncertain in how they would play out. So climate change going to accelerate or decelerate was one of the questions that we asked ourselves 5 years ago. We might also be asking ourselves a question this year about, one of the other questions we asked in the last time around was, will climate change drive migration to our region or migration away from our region? Because that can be an interesting question to understand whether or not your assumptions about population growth are going to be accurate or not. So once we've identified those critical uncertainties, then we use those to kind of play with scenario frameworks, and I'll show you what that looks like in just a moment. But that helps us understand, if you had accelerating climate change and a bad economy, what might that look like for us? If you had accelerating climate change and mass migration, what does that look like for us? And you do sort of the 4 quadrants. And then at the end, we write our scenario stories. Sort of stolen all of my thunder from the next couple of slides, so it'll be less wordy than it might have been. To identify our driving forces, we'll go through an exercise where we talk about them in terms of the STEEP framework, which is societal, technological, economic, environmental, and political. And sometimes you'll see this called the STEEP R matrix, and you consider political and regulatory separate. I find that it's really hard to separate them when you're brainstorming and having a conversation. So we will just do those as one category. And so that's the very first step. And this last time around, I think we generated 400 virtual sticky notes. The second step then is identifying those critical uncertainties. And we do that by rating every one of those external forces based on the scale of the impact that it could have and what the future might look like and how certain we are that we can predict what will happen. And so the ones that are high impact and high certainty, we call those our key trends, and we consider them through all of our scenarios. And the ones that are high impact and high uncertainty become what we call the critical uncertainties, which is what we consider in our third step. Do you have a question, Commissioner?
No, I was just saying, yeah.
It's you basically do an Eisenhower matrix and you pick the ones from the top left and the top right.
That's what I was, saw me.
Exactly. And then exploring the scenario frameworks, last time around, we had 7 critical uncertainties, and we did this really fun exercise where we considered them in 20 different combinations. And so for each critical uncertainty, you do what we call the axes of uncertainty. So this is an automated vehicles example from the Netherlands from 2016. But basically, their axes of uncertainty were that you had high technological development or low technological development, and you had either restrictive policies or supportive policies. And in the exercise that we do, we basically look at those quadrants and you imagine how things would be different if you had a lot of technology development and supportive policies versus restrictive policies and low development. And we do that for all of our uncertainties. And then we think about how if we combined multiple uncertainties together, you would get different versions of the future. And that's the funnest part of the entire thing. I keep telling everybody internally, we've got this hard sort of math scanning work to do to get us started. And then we get to go right once upon a time. We will be doing 4 scenarios this time around. So looking ahead, we're doing, we start our first internal workshop tomorrow. And then next week we have our workshop with you, the commission, and the ELT. And that will be input that we will use into developing those scenario frameworks and then writing our scenarios. The focus of the workshop that we will be doing together is the first 2 steps. So the first half of the workshop will brainstorm external forces, and the second half will use a scoring system to identify which ones we think are critical uncertainties for writing our scenarios. And then we will take the work from the workshop with you and combine it with the internal workshop output that we're getting over the next 2 weeks at the same time period. And to prepare for the workshop, I love to assign homework and pre-work. So if you get a chance, please listen to the podcast, which is from 2020 during the height of the pandemic. But I think it still stands given what's happening in the world today. And there's an accompanying article called Learning from the Future by the same author that was interviewed for the podcast, Peter Skoblik. And then take a few minutes as you have time to scan for interesting trends or signals. Signals are the things that make you go, huh, what if, right? It's like that article about, I don't know, a few years ago, I read one about somebody basically using a water solution with a bunch of iron particles in a bucket and saying I could make a battery out of this. Like that's a weak signal of a way technology could change. So this is, I usually do this by whatever I'm reading in the morning, social media, TikTok, the news, wherever you get your information, doesn't matter. They show up everywhere. And if you see some interesting ones, write them down and bring them to the workshop because they will help you with the brainstorming that we're going to do. And with that, that's what I have this morning.
I have them. Thank you.
Yeah, I was fascinated to read all that, Cassidy. Never thought of that, Cassidy. Do we do that as part of our process?
We do a little bit of it, but we're mainly looking kind of sideways and forward.
Yeah. So my question is really, I don't really know how we go about this, but you slide 11, you had all the various societal, technology, economic, political.
Yeah.
How do we broaden our perspective? How do we get out of the tunnel of being part of the PUD and seeing the world as we see it every day? How do we get perspectives beyond our own to incorporate? Or do we need the perspectives, or do we just need to know the essential elements, like we may not be telling power in the daytime, or battery will get invented and our whole business model will change, or I don't know.
It's kind of a mix of all of the above. So we'll have the workshop with you. And then for the internal workshop, basically I sent a help wanted ad to the leadership team, to the executive leadership team, and said, here's the qualities of the people that we're looking for. It doesn't matter what your role is. It's right. The people that are always saying, I read this really fascinating thing the other day. Or I was talking to Bob at a barbecue and he said he read this thing. Because getting outside of our own bubble and what we do every day is sort of a matter of where's your perspective on a daily basis. You'll meet the strategic foresight team when we do the workshop next week as well. There's 9 of us working together for this phase of it. And part of what we're doing is an intentional scanning of outside resources and news sources and other places and repositories of trends information. And there's a number of futurists out there that publish their thinking about weak signals and the trends that think are important and how they might interact over the next 20 years. So we'll be pulling in a lot of that external perspective. It sort of becomes, I always like to say that this process is less prescriptive than it sounds. And that we do the workshops internally, we're going to have a workshop with you, we're doing all of our thinking, and all of that sort of comes together in various steps so that we then always have that opportunity to say, hey, we think we missed something in a workshop. Does that answer your question?
It does. I just think it's challenging.
It's really challenging.
And I think that you're right. We can pull from people in the organization who aren't connecting wires or dealing with power.
Well, and, you know, everybody
different perspectives too.
Right. And actually, interestingly, every position at the organization brings its own set of perspectives, because what you see happening in the communities is different if you're the person out there building infrastructure than you are if you're the person who's reading about it in the news. And so all of those perspectives become really valuable.
I'm always thinking about the people like approach me and worried about solar flares and the system, right? So obviously that's potential future.
Yeah.
Cataclysmic. I mean, out in the pandemic is a great example, right? Something we didn't see.
Well, an interestingly, there's a little bit of an art form as we go through this process of identifying the things that are wild cards that we won't actually write into our scenarios. So we probably won't write a scenario about the Cascadia fault finally cracking and the earthquake
right.
letting us slide into the ocean, because that's a thing that you can't really plan for, but and that's where business continuity and disaster response
right.
plans come into play versus strategic scenario writing.
Right.
And so then the question becomes, solar flares, do we think of them as a one-time event or
right.
an ongoing problem? If they're an ongoing problem, then potentially we bring them into a scenario. Versus if we think it's just a single solar flare that does an immense amount of damage, then that's disaster response. So,
yes.
Follow on to your question, I want to make sure I understand this. That
yeah.
The workshop that the board is involved in, we're taking ourselves out of our business.
Right.
Focuses on on what might we do or what might we not do, what we
right.
change. We're totally cut off from our business.
Yes.
And that will be our focus in terms of looking at future challenges and opportunities.
Yes. For the purpose
okay.
of this workshop and this step in the process, we're not thinking about how it impacts us or what
okay.
we would have to do to respond. Our perspective is completely outside to the forces that are happening out in the world, climate change, the economy, global trade relationships, war, strife, whatever that is, and thinking about how those will impact our communities. This fall, we will do the work to talk about what that would require from us and our operations.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It also seems like when we have the workshop, it's important for the three of us in very broad terms establish what expectations we have. Customers and how the strategic plan will serve.
And that will be part of the work that we do actually next year.
Okay.
So this workshop is really literally about imagining how the
okay.
world might change and our communities might look different. Your perspective on the policies and the things that we need to focus on in terms of meeting those challenges for the future will be the work that we do about this time next year.
Well, I think it's going to be quite interesting to visualize and imagine the future, how we can expect, because as much as we plan or put the input, we don't have the control.
Right.
You know, a disaster coming or whatever, and are we prepared for that? So I received phone calls or conversations with people, and they are really freaked out about the data centers, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to need a lot of water. What is going to happen? In grassroots, the population that we belong to, the diverse communities, we don't have the business education about compost, simple state baby steps, because in our countries, I mean, have a garbage can is a luxury.
Yeah.
So that part of education is invisible in the eyes of the people that are in the policy platforms. They don't even look at it, that impact. Whatever, if you don't have that base education, so impact in our planet, impact in planning all this. So how many people do and separate the garbage in their homes? So I don't know, that is something that uncertainty. So
yeah, and those are the types of things that we want to explore in this workshop, which is what is the impact potentially 20 years from now about whether or not we are effectively recycling resources today or building that infrastructure or starving that infrastructure, right? That's a thing that we as a public utility don't have any control over, but could influence what our communities look like and what they might potentially, what life looks like for them in 2045.
And I visited a few landfills and I wasn't sure. I wish I wouldn't be there. So to see all the garbage and how the machines do put together, and you know, it's like, and here in your home, you try to separate the things and visualize and witness in the landfill that even though matrix and things like that is like, so what's going on? So yeah. Anyway, so I was a big show. See, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. We're looking forward to next week. We will have post-it notes and flip charts and see you then.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Laura, I'm glad we made it 3/4 of the way through that before Cascadia rising threw us in the sea. So that was nice.
Everybody always wants to talk about waves in the volcanoes.
And, you know, we have done a lot. Yeah. Part of having the new office in Arlington with more expanded capabilities, have more assets on the other side of the biggest river in the county.
For business continuity.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So next is item 5 of our general manager report. Do you have a report for us, John?
We do, and we're starting off with your wellness challenge for April, because I know all three of you love joining us on our wellness challenge journey. The wellness challenge for April is focused on getting outside and getting moving. From April 8th through the 29th, employees are encouraged to enjoy the great outdoors by walking, biking, or participating in any activity that gets you outside and moving. The district also had a blood drive on March 24th. There were 18 donors, 2 of which were first-time donors, and 17 life-saving units were collected supporting local patients through BloodWorks Northwest. The next blood drive will be scheduled for June 2nd. Our Snow Leave Paid Family Medical Leave program celebrated 2 major milestones. The district insured voluntary paid family medical leave program, referred to as Snow Leave, was approved by Washington State, and we formally adopted our Snow Leave Trust for program benefits. The program will be effective on July 1st of this year. And finally, the district officially launched the To the Cloud project, an exciting milestone that moves this critical project from planning into execution. The kickoff brought together the project team, district leadership, and our implementation partners, marking the start of a major investment in modernizing the district's core SAP platform. This program is designed to strengthen system reliability, support long-term operational and finance processes, and position the district for improved customer service well into the future. During the kickoff, the team shared the overall program structure, guiding principles, and a phased delivery approach that will help mitigate risk while ensuring continuity of day-to-day operations. The session also introduced our system integrators, Cognizant, and Delaware Consulting as key partners in the work. We're excited to begin this next chapter, which will deliver a more modern, user-friendly SAP environment. That's our report.
Yeah. I was wondering if someone could talk to us about the safety award we got from APPA. It's astounding. You know, 9 years ago when I started, our safety record not very good. It had improved the previous couple of years, but it's phenomenal to go from a not a very strong place to receive the award. So
yes.
Congratulations, everyone.
Thank you. It is a big accomplishment. And we'd be happy to have someone come speak about what we've done to make that happen.
The commissioners are interested.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next is item 6, commission business. 6A, commission reports. Are there any reports, commissioners?
I have none.
Also have none. Next is 6B, our commissioner events calendar. Are there any changes to the commissioner events calendars? Page 118 of our packet.
I have a question. Do we need to add the April 9th calendar?
April 9th. What is April 9th?
That's actually a special meeting.
Oh, okay.
The governance planning
committee. That will be on the, yeah. Thank you. Super.
Substation.
Commissioner, you're pretty busy on April 16th.
Mm-hmm. On back and forth, Mount Lake Terrace.
Hearing no change to the event calendar, we'll next look at 6C, the February 2026 district dashboard, which begins on page 127 of our packet. questions on this?
I didn't have any. No.
I only had a question, and maybe I've been told the answer, but on the electric system reliability, we were working up a blue sky metric, and I'm wondering if we're going to put that on this. I would love to see. It's because there's so many storms in different seasons, it's really hard to look at this.
Yes. Laura Lemke, Program Director. So we have been working on it. Credit to People in Collins organization that have done all of the math to figure out how to make it work. And we are just in the middle of working through the reporting right now. And I anticipate that we will be adding that to commission dashboards later this spring. Probably not with the March dashboard, likely with the April dashboard.
Awesome.
You're welcome.
Any other questions on the dashboard? Next, we'll move to 6D, consider a resolution announcing the Office of Commissioner of Public Utility District Number 11, which can be filled at the next general election. I'll call for a motion.
I move approval.
Are there any questions or comments, commissioners, on the resolution?
I have none.
I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed say nay.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed unanimously. Next, item 7, our governance planning calendar. Are there any changes to the governance planning calendar? This is on page 133 of the packet.
Just on the to be scheduled page, the last bullet, rates program strategy, I thought I saw on May the 5th, there would be a briefing. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, it is. It just for the taking on
okay. Schedule. All right.
And just as an FYI, we have been trying to work with the teams to get the items of to be scheduled along to the actual date. So hopefully some of those will move along. It is quite large.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Any other changes to the planning calendar?
No.
Is there any further business to come before the board today? Okay, hearing none, it is 10:32 a.m. and our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.